Hello and welcome to the 15 Minute Book Club with me, your host, David Wares, produced by Wilson of Warm Winter Productions and brought out into the world by our man from Yucatan, El Gavster. It's almost Christmas, it's snowing outside, and so this week's topic can only be A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. And first off, we really need to be carrying two things in our head. The story itself, but also the context of the story, which is equally as important. Especially when considering how successful this very short novel has become. It hasn't been out of print in 178 years, which isn't bad for a Christmas story, and I'm not sure whether Hallmark movies will last quite as long. Maybe, maybe not. And yet when this classic Christmas story opens, it opens like this. Marley was dead to begin with. There is no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the clerk, the undertaker and the chief mourner. Scrooge signed it, and Scrooge's name was good upon change for anything he chose to put his hand to. Old Marley was as dead as a doornail. That's how the novel opens. It's dark, and for a good while it doesn't get any lighter. So first off, let's get an overview. A Christmas Carol was published shortly before Christmas in 1843, and it sold out the entire first edition by Christmas Eve. It was first read in Victorian England, a country that was entering the full bloom of the Industrial Revolution. England was a country of extremes at this time, a country of wealth but also of grinding poverty, a country of strict moral codes, but where you could buy a prostitute on just about any street corner, a country where a small number of rich men controlled everything, and a large number of poor people struggled to survive. It was the dawn of the British Empire. It was 30 years after we'd vanquished the French at Waterloo, and we'd gone on to do exactly what Napoleon had accused us of. We'd focused on trade, on business, and on profit. And in this new environment of profit and loss, of contracts and shipping, of winners and losers, there were no rules. You made your money or you got broke. London was the commercial and cultural capital of the world, and there was a growing illiterate middle class who were getting fat off the profits of this revolution and could afford to set time aside to read newspapers and to read novels and to gather round the family piano singing carols at Christmas. And of course, there were also the very rich of London who were amongst the wealthiest people who had ever lived. Alongside wealth, there was also grinding poverty. The poor died young and they often died in misery. Factories were a terrible place to work. A single shift lasted between 14 and 16 hours, and that was 6 days a week. Children as young as four were employed on pittance wages to do extremely dangerous jobs. Democracy was in its infancy, and only the wealthy had a vote. It would be another 75 years and a million dead in the Great War before ordinary men got to elect their leaders, and it was a decade after that before women even got a look in. And meanwhile, Christmas wasn't particularly popular. It wasn't well celebrated, and it wasn't the absolute highlight of the year as it is now. It was merely a religious festival for which the poor, if they were lucky, might get a day off work. But a few things occurred to change that. In the 1820s, Christmas carols began to become popular again through the publication of collections of carols. Again, the middle class, with their increasing literacy, the popularity of learning instruments such as the piano, and the sheer luxury of people having a living room in which to congregate, all these elements converged to make carols popular again. And on top of that, Queen Victoria had married a German prince, Albert, who brought a Germanic cultural shift into the lives of the upper and middle classes. One of those things he brought over to England, which is still with us now, was a Christmas tree. And 8 years before A Christmas Carol was published, Sir Henry Cole came up with the first postage stamp, which allowed even quite poor people to contact others throughout the country at a uniform price. This helped to popularise the Christmas card, and the first commercial card became available, and again it was commissioned by the redoubtable Sir Henry in 1843. And on that first card was featured three generations of a family raising a toast to the card's recipient. On either side were scenes of charity, with food and clothing being given to the poor. And in that exact same year as the first popularly available Christmas card, Charles Dickens published A Christmas Carol, in which, amidst this tale of redemption, he set up the template for how we should enjoy Christmas. It's the template we still observe now. So within a short time, Christmas, as we know it in Britain, was if not invented, then reinvented. Cards, gifts, feasts, light, snow, Christmas trees, charity and general celebration. It hasn't changed much since, except that Father Christmas now wears red instead of green. So thanks for that, Coke caller. And yet it had all existed before. We've been celebrating midwinter in these British Isles with feasts and gifts and lights and copious amounts of alcohol for thousands of years. But Dickens reinvented it. He popularised and he codified it. With the publication of A Christmas Carol, he made it a cornerstone of our culture. So that's the background. And while it might sound like I'm overstating Dickens' role in the creation of what we now call Christmas, if anything, I'm underselling Dickens and the impact of his novel on our culture. The novel itself is structured in five staves. After all, it is a carol, a song, and music is written on musical staves. Christmas carols in particular are all about love and forgiveness and redemption and the nativity, which is the literal birth of love and compassion. But it begins in darkness, in death, in misery, because the central character, Ebenezer Scrooge, is a miser, and he literally brings with him misery, misery. I'll just read this little quote from page 10. "A Merry Christmas, Uncle. God save you," cried a cheerful voice. It was the voice of Scrooge's nephew, who came upon him so quickly that this was the first intimation he had of his approach. "Bah," said Scrooge, "humbug." He had so heated himself with rapid walking in the fog and frost, this nephew of Scrooge's, that he was all in a glow. His face was ruddy and handsome, his eyes sparkled, and his breath smoked again. "Christmas, a humbug, Uncle," said Scrooge's nephew. "You don't mean that, I'm sure." "I do," said Scrooge. "Merry Christmas. What right have you to be merry? What reason have you to be merry? You're poor enough." "Come then," returned the nephew gaily. "What right have you to be dismal? What reason have you to be morose? You're rich enough." Scrooge, having no better answer ready on the spur of the moment, said, "Bah," again, and followed it up with, "humbug." "Don't be cross, Uncle," said the nephew. "What else can I be," returned the uncle, "when I live in such a world of frills as this? Merry Christmas. Out upon Merry Christmas. What's Christmas time to you but a time for paying bills without money, a time for finding yourself a year older and not an hour richer, a time for balancing your books and having every item in them through a round dozen of months presented dead against you. If I could work my will," said Scrooge indignantly, "every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled down with his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart. He should." "Uncle," pleaded the nephew. "Nephew," returned the uncle sternly, "keep Christmas in your own way and let me keep it in mine." "Keep it," repeated Scrooge's nephew, "but you don't keep it." "Let me leave it alone then," said Scrooge. "Much good it may do you, much good it has ever done you." Scrooge is convinced from his own experience that Christmas, that charity, that happiness indeed, are luxuries that he can't afford to enjoy. As he sees the two gentlemen who come calling for a donation to the poor, "Are there not prisons?" asks Scrooge. "Plenty of prisons," said the gentleman, laying down the pen again. "And the union workhouses?" demanded Scrooge. Are they still in operation?" "They are still," returned the gentleman. "I wish I could say they were not." "The treadmill and the pool are in full vigour then?" said Scrooge. "Both very busy, sir." "Oh, I was afraid from what you had said first that something had occurred to stop them in their useful course," said Scrooge. "I am very glad to hear it." Scrooge, as he is clearly informed by the ghost of Jacob Marley, with his grasping, scraping, coverless ways, is ripe for eternal damnation. And the rest of the novel is concerned with how he is redeemed and explaining why he became what he was. Along the way, he meets the spirit of Christmas past, present and future. He sees the lives of the people on whom he inflicts misery. He hears what people actually think of him and he sees the error of his ways. A Christmas Carol is a morality tale in which the moral is heeded and in which the sinner is redeemed. In that sense, the narrative reflects the Christian belief in redemption. No matter how badly you have sinned, if you repent, if you change your ways, then you can be redeemed. But the question remains, is it a Christian story? The spirits of Christmas who take Scrooge on his journey of redemption appear elemental, not possibly even pagan, but not especially Christian. And the redemption is purely human. Scrooge becomes a better person. He laughs, he is charitable, He uses his wealth to support Tiny Tim's physical recovery and a good health, and he is welcomed into his nephew's party. Moreover, the memory of his nephew's mother, Scrooge's kind-hearted sister who died young, is again deeply human and kind, but not religious in any way. And when he is redeemed, he doesn't suddenly go to church. Instead, he buys a huge goose for a feast. The characters in the novel, good and bad, are good and bad in themselves, not relation to any concept of God. There are references to God, of course, and to the star in the sky, the religious icon that guided the three kings to Bethlehem and the birthplace of Christ. But these references sit alongside earthier pleasures, feasting, warmth, family ties, and the base instincts of greed and callousness. A Christmas Carol tells a timeless story of kindness overcoming misery, and it is wrapped in a veneer of Christianity, but that veneer is faint. I'm not going to critique the entire story. You all know it, and it's never been out of print. There are dozens of movie and radio adaptations. Even the Muppets did a version. A great version, in fact. Although the Alistair Sim movie is, in my opinion, by far the best. The fact is, this novel was conceived as a redemption story, and its target was Victorian England. Dickens himself was part of a wave of reformers who wanted to improve the lot of the poor and increase the general kindness and generosity of society. What Dickens told those wealthy and middle-class and poor Victorian families was, this is how we should be. This is how we should live. This is how we should treat our fellow human beings. Because as I said at the beginning, Charles Dickens reinvented Christmas so that we could all, not just Scrooge, but all of us, be better people. And as this is the Christmas edition of the 15-Minute Book Club, I'll leave you with this final quote. When Scrooge has been through the fire of recognising his own failures and the misery he has inflicted, he is redeemed, he's born again, a renewed man of kindness and generosity. And this is how the story ends. Scrooge was better than his word. He did it all and infinitely more. And to Tiny Tim, who did not die, he was a second father. He became as good a friend, as good a master, and as good a man as the good old city knew, or any other good old city or town or borough in the good old world. Some people laughed to see the alteration in him, but he let them laugh. A little heeded them, for he was wise enough to know that nothing ever happened on this globe for good at which some people did not have their fill of laughter in the outset. And knowing that such as these would be blind anyway, he thought it quite as well they should wrinkle up their eyes in grins as have the malady in less attractive forms. His own heart laughed, and that was quite enough for him. He had no further intercourse with the spirits, but lived upon the total abstinence principle ever afterwards. And it was always said of him that he knew how to keep Christmas well, if any man alive possessed the knowledge. May that truly be said of us, and all of us. And so, as Tiny Tim observed, God bless us, everyone. And on that festive note, this is the 15-Minute Book Club wishing you a merry, merry Christmas. Yeah.